So what we tried to talk about this morning, very superficially obviously, was that there seems to be some intrinsic characteristics of the way biological complexity is organized. So we're all familiar with the idea that we all have the same, all organisms share certain molecular similarities, that we use DNA in a similar way to bacteria. It's less, at intermediate levels of organization, things are very different. Our proteins are very different than bacteria in detail. But then at higher levels of organization, we pop up into a regime in which there are universal features again, I think. But we less well understand that. And so the way we're trying to tell the story this morning was, we had two things we could look at. We could look at the convergence of biological organisms defining the same strategies independent of evolution, where the convergence within organisms. But also you can look at the convergence of organisms with advanced technologies. And that's also striking because the presumably the mechanisms are quite different. Engineers and natural selection are in principle quite different. So it's a pretty superficial slice through this issue of what is the nature of biological complexity. But one of the things we wanted to make sure we got across was the idea that it involves robustness and fragility in extremis, in the sense that you have very extremely robust systems, very fragile systems. So now what we want to do is talk about computational complexity. Quite different question. So now we're asking, are there intrinsic features of the problems of computation? And how does that affect how we can study biology? So if we're going to study biology with modeling and computation, what are the properties of computation itself which will affect how we're able to do that? And then, how do these two things relate to each other? How does the intrinsic nature of biological organization relate to the intrinsic nature of what we can do with computation? So we're going to start out with a little toy example just to motivate us here. Chemical oscillator. And again, it doesn't really, at this point, this is going to be an example you'll see more of tomorrow morning. At this point, the details don't matter a lot. It's just you've got A and B are externals, X and Y are the internals, and you sort of have this reaction, that's those parts, that and that. Okay. So here's just a differential equation describing that, a simple little nonlinear differential equation. And what's interesting about it is you can sort of analytically play with this. It's only two-dimensional, so you can do a lot with this that you can't do. And so when I say it's not scalable, it means that we're gonna look at it in a way that couldn't do if it was higher dimensional. Okay. So the idea is that under those circumstances, you can prove that so B and A are external variables. Think of them as parameters that describe this system. Otherwise, everything else is it's all been non-dimensionalized, so you have these two external. And these are basically these external variables that you would be putting into this system. And so the idea is that if we want to attack this problem, we have three choices in general. So this is a nonlinear system. It is a hybrid. We'll look at hybrid. So you've sort of had three choices, which is there's lots of theory of nonlinear systems, but they don't involve scalable algorithms. You have to handcraft solutions to individual cases. There's rich theories for linear systems that have algorithms that are scalable. And we could spend the whole day talking about what scalable means. We're going to be vague about that because it's a detail that we don't think is really essential. Your probably intuitive sense of it is probably okay, that as the problem gets bigger, the growth and the complexity of your computation grows in a nice way with it. And we'll say a little bit more about what's not nice, like exponential growth. And then there's hacking. Neither theory nor, and that's what, actually, this is how we do most of complexity is over here. So this is, most of what's in my laptop is over here. So what we're trying to get is a theory that actually has scalable algorithms. That's the new thing that we're going to spend today and tomorrow morning on, is that there's new theory with scalable algorithms that we think is of direct relevance to studying the problems of biological complexity, trying to understand the networks. And of course, most reach is neither scalable nor theory, but anyway. So if you look at, let's just take a particular, if you take this point in the AB parameter space, plug it in, and then start a whole bunch of different initial conditions, you get this phase portrait. And so the idea is that at these parameter values, you spiral out to this limit cycle, or if you're outside, you spiral in. And so you have that limit, that's a limit cycle oscillation. Okay. And you could figure that out either by running a lot of simulations or by doing a little bit of analysis, because it's only two-dimensional. Okay. And of course, we're taking a very simple view of this, and we're going to stick with this picture for the next today and tomorrow morning, and then Friday afternoon we'll get into the whole stochastic picture much more. Now, but the point is, what happens outside of that red region? Well, if you go here and you do a whole bunch of simulations, you get a kind of a picture that it does that, right? We have to do a whole lot of simulations. We have to simulate all sorts of initial conditions. And if we come over here, we have a whole bunch of things. So it looks like outside of here, it's always stable. The actual dynamics are different in each case. You can see those two phase portraits are different. And the equilibrium that it goes to is different in each case, but it always seems to go in equilibrium. So we might conjecture on the basis of this that outside of this red region, it's stable. The problem is, how would we actually really be convincing about that? And here's the part that isn't scalable. In general, we would have a problem in which we'd have a differential equation that had two kinds of things in it, have states and parameters. And all parameters are really states that don't change. So there isn't really much of a distinction between the two in this setting. But the idea is that what we have to do to understand a system like this is, on the one hand, we have to try lots of different initial conditions. So let's suppose we grid the space of X, and we grid the space of P, and we try it for a whole bunch of points, right? Well, the total number of grid points scales with the number of grids, number of grid lines to the power of the dimension of the space, and the number of grid lines to the power of the dimension of the state space, right? So if M and N in this case are 2, that's no big deal, right? So we can grid it up pretty fine, and we can do this. The problem is, if M and N are big, this is horrible. It has polynomial growth in the size of the grids, but exponential growth in the dimension. Okay? And it's the difference between polynomial growth in the grid dimensions and the exponential growth here that is killing us. It's the exponential growth that kills us. So if we stick in low dimensions, we can do high gridding without too much trouble. That's what we've done here. But as the dimension grows, this is hopeless. So simulation alone can't tell us very much about these systems. They can help us form conjectures. But we're overwhelmed by this exponential scaling in high dimensions of problems like this. This is the central challenge that we have to face if we're going to be able to study large networks in biology, because they're nonlinear, like this, and they're high dimensional. And so we have to find some way of overcoming this exponential. What we want to talk about the rest of today is, how should we think about that? We want to try to do that as much as possible, avoiding having to go through what a Turing machine is, and what decidability is, and what the class P is, and what NP is. We'll have to do a little of that, but we're going to try to do as little as possible. Because to some extent, it doesn't matter whether you like Turing machines or some other model. None of this stuff matters all that much. There's something that's quite essential. We think we've extracted that, but we'll see. Okay. So one thing we're going to find out to do, and I'm not going to try to do that. I'm just going to give you a hint of what we're going to see later, and particularly tomorrow morning, is that what you could try to do is actually prove that for some whole region of parameter space, the system was stable to an equilibrium. And it turns out the way you do that, of course, is you can solve for the equilibrium, and so the equilibrium values are simply the solutions of these equations, right? Because you just set x dot and y dot to 0. So the first thing we notice is that if we want to study the steady state characteristics of these biochemical networks, the steady state characteristics are solutions to polynomial equalities and inequalities. Of course, we'd add some inequalities, like the fact that we're only interested in positive solutions, so there'd be inequalities on the x's and the y's, and then there'd be equalities, and this would relate the values of a and b to the steady state or equilibrium values. Now, the problem is, engineers and physicists use equilibria differently. Engineers always are talking about an airplane flying at 30,000 feet in equilibria. It's not thermodynamic equilibrium. It means that, relatively speaking, it's fairly steady in flight. Okay, so I have to be careful. I shouldn't use equilibrium because it doesn't have anything to do with thermodynamic equilibrium. Then what you can do is you can write the deviations of this system about that equilibrium. Okay. What you'd like to prove is that for all variations of A within some region, this thing is stable to whatever equilibrium there is. And then you put some bounds on that, and you put some other bounds, and you want to make, these have to be positive, a bunch of inequalities. It turns out what you have to do is then find a thing called a Lyapunov function. And again, we're going to hopefully teach you about how that's done without having to teach you all of dynamical systems and control theory. We think there's an essence of it that is fairly easy to do, and we'll do that tomorrow morning. But I'm just going to give you a flavor of it. And the idea is that you find a Lyapunov function, you write down all these inequalities and polynomial equalities, and you got to solve a big set of equations. It's hard, but we now have nice scalable ways to do that. So the question is, for what values of A and B does there, for what bounds on A and B, can we put bounds on A and B and then prove that this thing is stable? And so it turns out you can actually get two simple regions because you can take this region and this region and you can get a fourth order Lyapunov function, and we'll explain again tomorrow morning what that does. What that does is actually let you in one shot prove that the system is stable. Okay. So it sounds like magic, and it sort of is. And it's an idea that's been around a long time. The only thing that wasn't very useful is because you couldn't compute anything. So the idea that you can use Lyapunov functions to prove stability is an old idea. The new idea is that you can systematically search for these things efficiently. And that's an extraordinary change in our capabilities. And I think it has potentially extraordinary impacts for what we can do in terms of systematically studying complex networks in biology. But again, it's like we're going from 1% to 2%. You know, it's like if we think of biology as being this whole room, then we used to be able to do half this glass, and now we can do the whole glass. The room is still largely uncharted territory. So I don't want to give the impression that we've done more than made little tiny progress. So if I look at the glass, we've doubled the amount of stuff in the glass. If I look at the room, we got a long ways to go. And so that would have been, so this was at this one point, this was at 0.6 and 1.1, you construct a Lyapunov. But the idea is we did this all in one shot, right? We didn't do, this is not doing individual simulations for all parameter values all at once. And so, okay, so you're going to hear tomorrow about how to do that, okay? Another example we might want to think about is so remember when we wrote down this set of equations, okay? So again, suppose we wanted to, I just ran simulations before. Now I actually proved that those simulations had this constrained integral property, okay? And I could prove that no matter what I put in for these parameter values, that constraint held, okay? But we might want to prove other things about this. We might want to prove the same sort of things. We might want to prove it's stable. We might want to prove that it transient responses. Again, we could run lots and lots of simulations, but we'd like to be able to say things about it. For one thing, we may not know all these numbers, right? So we'd like to be able to say, well, if the numbers are in some plausible range, are things going to be work? Okay. So the big picture that we're after here is how do we study large networks? And we do a lot of things. We take data, we do models, and then we make inferences about the models, and then we go back and take more data. It turns out the inference part has been the hardest to scale the large problems. So people have worked very well at how to take lots of data. So we're working hard to scale up taking of data. And there's lots of effort in how to be able to construct, manipulate, and exchange models. The hard part is actually reasoning about the models and doing inference. And in some sense, science as an enterprise has simply abandoned research almost on that subject. We don't systematically pursue that. There are parts of computer science and parts of mathematics that do. So, this is kind of out of order. Anyway, these are the people that are working on it. A lot of people are here talking about, so this is tomorrow morning, this is the funding. This workshop was funded by Grant. This is both Japanese government. They're kind of ahead of our country in thinking about these problems. Heat shock examples, metabolic control examples. We're going to hear about multi-scale theories and then theory stuff. So okay. So here's a kind of So here's the key ideas. First of all, we kind of gave a hint, and this is the tip of the iceberg. I mean, mostly unresolved, but we have at least a hint that there are fundamental laws governing the organization of biological networks. Okay. Obviously, we need to know more about that. We also, I'm suggesting simulation is scalable, is not scalable because complex uncertain systems have an exponentially large number of simulations that answer biologically meaningful questions. And then the other issue is multi-scale, large-scale stochastic simulation is also an essential technology. I'm not saying that we don't want to do simulation. We've got to actually, we need a lot of research on simulation itself, generating time histories that are consistent with a stochastic ensemble characteristic of the real details. So that's tomorrow. So the idea is that without exploiting the properties of biological networks, the complexity of them is overwhelming. If they were indeed arbitrary collections of, if we had arbitrary high-dimensional nonlinear differential equations, can't say anything about those. But they're not arbitrary. A simulation is not scalable. What we need is we need automatic scalable inference processes, and we are going to talk about how to do that using semi-algebraic geometry and semi-definite programming. And again, don't let these words scare you. We think we can tell you about this in a way that's accessible, or Pablo is going to. Okay. And then we actually need Gillespie and Petzold to integrate these into a single methodology, and we'll hear about their progress in doing that. So the scientific iteration, again, is you want to do experiments and gather data. You make assertions about the data. And then you reason about the assertions and then try to make inferences, okay? And so again, we're not doing so good on three. So what are the kind of things you'd like to do? So what are the properties in a model? You'd like to say something about a model. I think one of the important things is where is it robust, where is it fragile? The other thing is, if we have a model, is it consistent with a set of data? So I'd like to be able to say, I have a model, I have a whole pile of data, but I also have a priori constraints on what biochemistry is capable of building. I would like to ask, is this model consistent? And in particular, is a structure fundamentally incompatible with data no matter how parameters are adjusted? That's the sort of thing you're doing. What are critical parameters? So if there's a set of parameters that we don't know, some of them we might need to do experiments to find. Some of them the system is so robust to that we don't need to know them very well. What is the best nest experiment to do to resolve that? These are sort of things. Simulation is useful but ultimately limited in these things. Of course, if we're going to do simulations, we want to do them correctly and fast, and that's a challenge in its own. And that's again, that's the Dan and Linda show tomorrow. So when we go to engineering, we have a bunch of design objectives. We want to be robust, uncertain in the environment. We want to use the scarce resources available to us efficiently. And we want the whole problem to be scalable to large numbers. Okay, so we don't want to build an internet that we can't add additional computers to. The other thing we'd like to do is have it be verifiable with short proofs. We'd like to have those properties actually be things that we can check and be comfortable with. So here's a way things could be. What you have is we already know that there's a trade-off between the eye, and this is a cartoon. The idea is that this is what this cartoon is meant to give you the feeling of, is that ideal performance and robustness have a trade-off. If we want to build things really robust, we have to add in all sorts of regulatory structures. We might have to add in insulation. We want to add in armor. We have all the sorts of things we might want to make something robust. That takes away from the performance we could get under ideal circumstances. Okay, so that, you know, think of a tank versus a Formula One race car. Right? You give up performance in order to be robust. There's a trade-off there. And we think that we could understand this better, but we believe that there's a trade-off. Here is a potential nightmare. Suppose that there was also a trade-off with verifiability. So what if it was the case that systems that were comprehensible and verifiable, that is, this is from an engineering point of view, the systems that we can build, that we can understand, are intrinsically inefficient and fragile. Okay, that would be horrible. Another way of thinking about it is it could be possible that the only truly robust systems are absolutely cryptic and incomprehensible. That's a possibility. There's nothing logically that tells us this isn't the case. But Gödel and Turing tell us that this is, in some sense, in worst case, the case. Okay. It looks like this is the way it is. It looks like, in fact, that these are not incompatible objectives. They're not identical. I'm not saying they're the same. It's just that they're not in the same kind of conflict with each other as they are with the ideal performance. So if we're doing robust design, the idea is that robust designs are also evolvable and they're also verifiability. Now, in engineering, this is in the process of forward engineering, this is important, but the idea, where would this come up in biology? Well, the idea is that if biological organisms are robust and evolvable, okay, And they aren't ideal, they don't have ideal performance. In fact, for the most part, they've given up substantial amounts of ideal performance in order to have this robustness and evolvability. Then they are comprehensible. If one understands the architectures, protocols, and structures that create this robustness and evolvability. If not, forget it, right? Now, a typical design in engineering tends to be over here. It's kind of maybe often not so robust. An interesting example is the Internet Protocol. It was designed with no, essentially not much evolvability in mind. When it was designed, they weren't concerned about, no one thought there'd ever be 100 million computers hooked to it. Right? What they worried about was making it really bulletproof, or nuke-proof, more precisely. So it was designed without regard to evolvability, was also designed without regard to ideal performance. It was designed for robustness. What it got for free was incredible evolvability. And it turns out it's not that bad in performance either, so it uses resources fairly wisely. What we're finding now is that we can develop a sort of post hoc a theory that actually explains why this must be true. And the impressive thing is, the more we understand a theory of the internet, the more, well, one of the things that's impressive is how good it was designed, and how the places in which this performance now is very, very bad, and there are regimes, there are parts of the internet that work very badly. It's possible to get tremendous performance enhancements with very small changes. So tiny tweaks can have dramatic, because the basic architecture is pretty good. And so without a theory, of course, you couldn't have made sense of any of that. So now that we have a theory, we can kind of look back and see more about this. Of course, this isn't about the internet, but it's an example. So we're now designing and implementing new protocols, and they work great, and they're small changes. They don't have to make large changes. And there's a big debate going on within the community. There's people who say the internet is broken, it's fundamentally broken, and we have to change it in enormous ways, radical ways, in order for it to scale to the next generation of the internet. And a while ago, I probably would have gone in that camp. I would have said, look, what we need to do is develop a theory of the internet and completely redesign it from scratch. That's what I would have thought. Once we had a theory, we could say, gosh, they already did a pretty good job. It probably wouldn't have evolved as far as it did unless it had a good job. So what we're going to do, we think, is make small tweaks and get, and the first thing is, obviously, you should make the small tweaks, see how much performance you get before you make radical changes. But how do you actually prove nothing bad can happen? Okay? That's actually a puzzle, right? How do you actually prove nothing? It's easy to show something bad might happen. I just exhibit a case, right? But how do I show nothing bad can happen? Obviously, we need both new modeling techniques and new proof techniques to do this. Okay? So here's the complexity lessons that I want to try to get. So first one, we've talked about this morning. Highly evolved systems are robust yet fragile. They have these extremes. Complexity implies fragility. We're going to talk about that today. And one thing we're going to get a little bit of is this sort of orthodoxy of order-disorder transition is really a red herring in understanding complexity. That's not a focus of today's talk. It's just a consequence of once we understand this, we'll notice. And this has been one of the great cul-de-sacs of the last few decades, is the pursuit of this as a organizing principle for complexity. So here's the complexity issue. We talked about this morning. What we're going to say is we're going to try to be more precise. And it's dual complexity implies primal fragility. And obviously, I have to tell you what I mean by that. But dual complexity basically means proof link. Primal fragility means ill conditioning. And obviously, I have to define those things and try to make sense of them. And the problem is I want to try to define them in ways that are accessible and capture the essence of it and don't depend on a lot of details like, is this a Turing machine model? Okay? Because we don't believe you need to know that it's not an essential feature. And first of all, what does fragility mean? The fragility just means the answer to the question changes a lot if you change things a little bit. So if you change the parameters of the problem, you change the assumptions of the problem a little bit, the answer changes a lot. That's a fragile problem. Complexity just means my shortest explanation of what's going on is long. So let's try to just set up this in cartoons, and then we'll get more and more technical. But I think we can get the essence of it with a cartoon. So what we have is we have two things we want to describe. We want to describe the set of possible system behaviors. That's our model of what's going on. And then, in some sense, if we want to prove that nothing bad can happen, we have to also describe the set of bad system behaviors. And yeah. No, it's much more than that. But that would be an example. That would be an example, yes. But it's much more than that. No. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see more about that. We're going to talk a lot about this. Yeah, it's related. It's related. Yeah. But no, it isn't Kolmogorov complexity. Okay, so what we would like to do, if we're building an engineering system, we want to make sure these things don't intersect. If we're trying to understand some biological system that we think we've got a good model of, we believe it's a good, we've got to capture the system right, we also have to want to try to check this out. Okay, so. And so, in some sense, again, this is a cartoon, how do we prove this? Well, often these sets can be very complicated. Here you can just look and see that they aren't intersecting. But the actual way you prove this, and we'll see why this is that you actually, it's often easier to construct a barrier, and you can sort of easily prove that this is on one side of the barrier and this side is on the other, inferring that they are non-intersecting. But the argument can be much easier, that this is on one side and this is on the other. That's a very standard way people do things in numerical analysis. This is just, again, a very cartoon picture. Here's a typical thing that we'd be interested in, is we've got a set of possible model behaviors. We've got a model. We've got all the set of experimental behaviors that are observed. And this is a proof that the model doesn't work. Because often, you have a model, and it has a huge number of unknown parameters. You don't know what they are. And you'd like to be able to say, well, structurally, there's a protein missing, because I don't care how you come up with the parameters. You can't explain the data. And the problem is you can only do so much with simulation. You can run simulation, 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 simulation. If you find a set of parameters that fit the data, fine. But if you don't, have you just not looked hard enough? Okay, you want a proof. This is one of the main things we'll talk about tomorrow morning is techniques for doing this. So what are the sources of uncertainty? Well, there's lots. There's actually uncertainty in the system you're modeling, right? Systems that you model in the real world have variations in their components and their environment. You also make modeling assumptions. You assume something's well stirred. You assume something's in quasi-steady state. You assume all sorts of things. Those contribute. You make computational approximations along the way. Or you can also incompletely describe this, right? There's all sorts of ways. There's all sorts of uncertainties. And we want to manage all these in a systematic and integrated way. So here's an example of a problem where it's not robust. And the idea is that if a system isn't robust, to convince you of that fact, I merely have to exhibit a point in the set. Okay. And that can often be relatively easy to do. Also, if there exists a model consistent with data, I can show you a single simulation or single series of simulations that fit the data. And then I can show you. I can say, look, I fit the data. And that's an easy thing for you to, we can agree very quickly. If, however, I want to do this, I have to give you a proof. I can't simply exhibit. I can't run a single simulation. In principle, I have to run an infinite number of simulations. I have to simulate everything. Well, obviously, that's not something we can do. Also, okay. Here's a situation where the system is robust, but there's no short proof. Again, a cartoon. We're going to suggest that this cartoon gives some flavor of a potential problem. So here's the idea. Here's an idea in a cartoon form. Is that notice that the system is, in fact, it's robust as stated, but it's fragile to small perturbations. And the idea is that the complexity, the high complexity of the proof, implies that there is this fragility to the assumptions. If I jiggle the sets a little bit, the answer changes. Okay. So what we need is we need rich modeling methods. We have to be able to do hybrid nonlinear DAEs, PDEs. We have to be able to manage all this uncertainty. We have uncertainty in all sorts of forms. We have uncertainty in the way we took our data. We have uncertainty in the parameters in our model. We even have uncertainty the fact that a lot of the uncertainty we have isn't parametric at all. It's because we have low-order models representing high-order systems. We want scalable automatic proof systems, and we want to be able to make inferences about these. And we want to be able to feed back from proof complexity to model fragility. And what we're going to talk about in the next today and tomorrow morning is there's been enormous progress on the first three. And I think we've got promising insights about four. So, and I'm not going to try, so, I think I'll skip this. Actually, so the problem is, I think I should come back to this. Okay. So I want to talk about different things you can compute. So remember we said the static characteristics of studying biological systems involves finding solutions to sets of equations. We want to find the equilibrium values, we want to find the steady states. Suppose we got a big metabolic model, we want to know what the steady state values of the concentrations are. We have to find zeros of polynomials. So the first thing is, suppose we have a function f, suppose it's a polynomial, and we plug in x and compute f of x. That gives us one point of a function. Let's assume that that's easy. A lot of times it is. It isn't always. But for the stuff we're talking about now, it's easy to run one simulation. It's easy to compute the polynomial functions if I give you one set of parameters and one set of concentrations. Okay? So I'm going to assume that's easy. I'm going to call that class of problems P. Now what that means technically is it scales polynomially. The complexity scales polynomially, not exponentially, in the size of the problem. Okay. But we're going to try to avoid the need to go into a lot of the theory of computational complexity. What's essential about this is that often, it so happens, that the functional evaluation step is easy, although many examples of where it isn't. Okay. Many examples of this, but for now. Okay. It will get there. It is not. We have not gotten to the notion of proof length yet. Okay. The dimension. Yeah. So if we have a polynomial, if this was a polynomial in high dimension, does the complexity of evaluating the polynomial grow as a polynomial function of the dimension or exponentially? It turns out polynomially. Okay. Now, the next question we can ask is we could search the function. So we could ask, does there exist an x with f of x less than some value gamma? Okay. Search can be harder than functional evaluation, obviously, right? It can be much harder to search over all values of x. We just talked about that. In general, it seems to be exponentially hard to do this. Okay. It's not known whether it's exponentially harder, but it looks like it is. So it looks like search can be harder than functional evaluation. Even if it's easy to evaluate f of x, it's hard to find out if there is an x that makes f, say, less than gamma, as an example. Call this NP. Little reason, it's got a non-deterministic polynomial. What that means is that if you're a good guesser, the problem is easy. It means that if I can guess the right answer, I can actually quickly check whether it is an answer. That sounds like a weird way to think about it. Here's the way to think about it that I think is easier. Is that these problems are, in what sense are these problems easy? These problems are easy in that if I find a solution, I can easily convince you that I found a solution, right? That's what makes them easy. So it may be hard for me to find one, but if somehow I find a value here, then it's easy for me to show you. Okay, but searching may be hard. Remember we said searching could be exponentially hard, but once I've found one, I can show you easily. Okay, so the basic idea, if it's true, then there is always a short proof. Okay, so if this is true, if this assertion is true, then there's always a short proof. But finding that short proof may be hard. Okay? So the sense in which it's easy is it always has a short proof. Okay? The sense in which it's hard is that proof may be hard to find. Okay. Next. So the idea is that if you have a system of this kind, and I want to prove to you with problems that are robust, I can exhibit a single simulation to you, and we can quickly agree on the answer. Okay? But it may be hard for me to find that. Okay. Now here's another problem. This is it true that for all x, f of x is bigger than gamma? Okay. Now, again, I'm assuming that f is easy to compute. But this is harder than the previous problem. Or it's different than the previous problem. In general, it seems to be. Because it's actually a more important problem. I mean, my claim is that this thing that we can't do with simulation, right? And so the idea is that it's a more important problem, and short proofs may not exist. It may be that this is true, and there is simply no short proof. Okay? Now, so there's fundamental asymmetries. We saw two asymmetries. There's an asymmetry between functional evaluation and search, which is P and NP, and there is an asymmetry between proving that something exists, proving there exists an X, versus proving that no X exists. These are two asymmetries. Of course, it's possible they're all the same. This is one of the great unresolved issues in theoretical computer science. But for now, we'll assume that the experts are right and that these are different. We want to explore these differences more. So the idea is that in this case, we'd want to give a proof, and that may be hard. So we have three questions we could ask. Given an f, given a function, and this is just like a scalar polynomial, but in general, we could have sets of equations, we could have all sorts of complicated things. We can imagine doing three different things with it. And they're sort of nested, right? First, you got to be able to compute the function at all. Even if that's easy, it may be hard to search the function. Okay. Just because there's a lot of points. So searching takes a lot of time. Okay, could be. And even if that were easy, it may be that this is very hard. So what we want to try to do is get a deeper understanding of this. So I claim the distinction between these three is critical. Now the thing that people most know about is the difference between these two. This is the idea that P is not equal to NP. But the distinction between this and this is every bit as critical as the difference between this and this. Okay. And so one of the cases that comes up is, suppose we're trying to minimize f of x. Typical case you try to do an optimization. Suppose we find a point here, and we think, oh gosh, I found the minimum. Great. Of course, here you can see it isn't, but if it was a high-dimensional space, you could have found a local minimum, you move around, you think you're good. Okay. The question is that really the minimum? Is it in fact, is gamma the minimum? The question is, for all x, is f of x greater than gamma? And the answer here is no. Right. So even if you're doing search, you need to be able to answer questions like this in order to know when you should stop your search. So it's not like search is only easy in this kind of trivial sense that if I am successful in the search, I can easily show you. But I can't prove to you that I've got the minimum until I can do this. I can just prove to you that I've gotten something as good as gamma. Okay? Now in this case, I do have the minimum, yes. So I want to be able to distinguish those two. So one of the things we might think about is what makes a problem harder. So here's one of the features that has been noticed, is within these classes, so we have this layered classes of problems, but how hard the problem is actually depends on the f. Okay? So there's two ways of thinking about these problems as being hard. And one of them comes out of theoretical computer science of computational complexity, that you have these layered classes of problems. And they usually tend to think of them sort of worst case over F or average over F. But then, within any given problem class, you have, within a given problem class, depending on F, the problems can be hard or easy. Okay. What we want to do is get a unified understanding of this, because the latter picture is the picture that comes out of numerical analysis. So numerical analysts worry about, okay, Is my f within a class of problems well conditioned or not? How hard is it to compute with a particular f? And trying to understand what f's are easy and what f's are hard within a given class. So we've got these two issues. We've got these two different problems, search and proof. And then within each one of them, we have easy or hard f's. Okay. So a way of thinking about it, and again, this is, I'm not sure this is more, not more misleading than not, but The idea is that complexity implies fragility. We want to try to understand if that is true and to what extent it's true. So here's one way of thinking about it that is also very misleading, but we'll try to correct, we'll correct what's misleading about this problem later. In this case, there does exist an X. There's lots of them. And they're probably pretty easy to find. Okay? So the idea is that this is usually, you would tend to think of this as an easy problem because there's lots of Fs, there's lots of Xs that satisfy it. It's probably you're going to find one. Okay? It's sort of this picture. It's probably pretty easy to find a point here. You just kind of get an old anneal thing and you're going to be okay. Here's another case. This is so far below that you can probably, in some ad hoc way, figure out a proof. Okay? It's kind of like this. Almost anything you do is going to work. Okay? Those are the problems we usually do, right? We try to find ways to turn problems into this. And then the idea is that, oh, then there's this case and things are hard. And again, I got to be careful with this. There's an aspect of this that's right and there's an aspect of this that's very misleading. So one way of thinking about the decomposition we see in the way different communities treat these problems is that you have these hard problems and the fields, these fields can almost be defined in terms of the assumptions they make to turn hard problems into easy ones. Okay. So what you do is you constrain your Fs. Everybody makes their own favorite assumptions about how do you constrain an F to take problems that are hard and make them easy. Okay. And they all make very different assumptions, and the assumptions made in one domain can appear bizarre in other domains. And then we have subjects like the internet that until recently had no theory. So now we're finally getting a theory of the internet comparable to the theory for these other things. But it too has its own little set of assumptions. And it turns out one of the difficulties is it doesn't necessarily, so there's this whole theory of communications. Let me go back before I get to biology. So this whole theory of communications, and the internet doesn't quite fit into it, and it doesn't quite fit into controls either. It has to have some, it's got its own new kind of set of things. And the question is, where does biology fit in this? Well, biology also could, in some sense, be thought of as fitting in needing its own set of assumptions. One of the things we're trying to do is get a much more unified picture of this as well. So one of our attempts is to create a unified theory that connects up some of those, and that's actually what we're going to talk about. Is that there's new directions that have allowed us to make some progress in connecting. You'll see, notice some pieces don't yet fit, although Pablo just tells me now he's made some progress on coding, so that hasn't been worked very much. But physics, dynamical systems, control theory, algorithms, aspects of economics have all been put together in a single sort of unified theory, and that's what you're going to hear about today and tomorrow morning. And it involves, you know, really genuinely new mathematics put together in new ways. And hopefully we're finally figuring out after a little while of beating our heads against this, and we'll see how we do it this afternoon and tomorrow morning, to strip out a lot of what seemed to be unnecessary mathematics and give you the essence of it. And then the question is, where does biology sit? Well, we think this new unified theory helps us with biology. That's tomorrow morning, is how do we apply this stuff to things like studying heat shock, studying metabolism. And so we'll actually concretely go through and talk about how do you prove stability, how do you prove robustness, how do you prove a model doesn't fit data, things like that. So what I want to try to do is see if we can understand these issues, in a context in which we don't need almost any mathematics at all. And here the physicists come to the rescue because they've already developed a very nice model system. It's misleading in very, very many ways. If we keep track of the ways in which it's misleading, we can actually learn something from this. Okay? So what I'm going to try to do is use the remaining bit of time to try to use this lattice model to explain these ideas in a way that doesn't where actually you can be the computer and you can do the computations in your head. Okay. So the abstractions we want to try to explain is this issue of robustness and fragility, what we mean by verifiability, what do we mean by complexity, and what do we mean by resource scarcity, and how can we get a theory that relates all of these seemingly unrelated subjects into a single unified picture. So I'm not going to try to give you the whole story. There's a rich and beautiful theory of phase transitions and percolation lattices. So those of you who know that, great. Those of you who don't, it's not important for this what I'm going to do with them. Although it enriches, it would help if you knew that, but I think we can do without it. So all we're going to do is think about, these are lattices in which we have, sites are either occupied or not, and I will color them black when they're occupied. There's another way I can color them, is I can color them in clusters. And the colors don't really mean anything. I'm just trying to use colors to indicate connected clusters. Okay? And I'll explain a little bit more about what I mean by connected. And then we're going to focus on, can we find a horizontal path from left to right, or right to left? So the horizontal paths we'll assume are connected only on their edges, so they only have four neighbors. We're not allowing diagonals. Okay? So there's a path, right? See, there's a path that goes from the left to the right, and is a complete continuous path. And I've colored it in black so that you could have seen it there was anyway. Okay. But there's also vertical paths, and they're dual paths. Now this is the part where this is not the way physicists treat the subject, and so I'm now introducing a little bit of a different thing, but it's just a different percolation lattice. So what now I'm assuming is, in constructing vertical paths, I'm allowing all eight neighbors, including diagonals. So this has a vertical path. Notice it doesn't have a horizontal path, but it does have a vertical path. Now it turns out you have either one or the other. You either have a vertical path or you have a horizontal path. Okay?
Why don't you just make the vertical path where you don't have occupied sites? Isn't that what you usually do?
Yeah, it's unoccupied.
No, but just without allowing diagonals as well.
Oh, then you don't have an if and only if. I want if and only if.
Right. Even if you do this on triangle paths.
I know, but I want an if and only if here. So these are just two different kinds of, this is just two kinds of different percolation. I know it's not quite the usual picture, but there's an advantage to doing it this way. So now what we have is we have vertical paths and horizontal paths. There's a critical phase transition at density 0.59, which means that the limit of large lattices, the probability of being below, 0.59, you are almost surely have a vertical path. Above 0.59, you almost surely have a horizontal path. And the idea is it's if and only if. Right? And notice that in order to have it be if and only if, the way I define the paths has to be different here. Okay? So now what I'm going to want to think about is, So if I think of the horizontal path, it's not connected here and it is connected here. Okay? So what I want to think about is robustness. Okay, so I want to put robustness into this picture. Now, it offers us a crude abstraction. And the idea is that the robustness of a path is how much is the path preserved under perturbations that attempt to... So it's like a game. You got somebody trying to break your path. How robust is your path to the removal of occupied sites? Okay. So what is verifiability? Verifiability is the length of the proof required to verify robustness. So either there is a path, and I show you the path, and the path length is my measure of complexity, or there is no path, and the path that shows that there isn't a path is the length. Okay, we'll go through this a little more carefully. Yeah.
Robustness means that there shouldn't exist any path once you take some sites, or that the...
Yeah, I will define it precisely in a minute. The general idea is we want our paths... A path can exist and be fragile because you could remove, say, one part and it goes away. So we want to measure robustness eventually. We want a quantitative measure of robustness, which is the persistence of a path and the presence of perturbations. So verifiability we'll think of in terms of the length of the path, either to prove a path exists or to prove a path doesn't exist. Okay. So now there's a problem with this that's very misleading. And the very misleading part of it is that even though these paths are different, they're essentially the same. Okay? And there's no duality gap. This is a very important point. I don't want to pretend that this is general. So the idea is that, in fact, this is what makes this easy, is that finding proofs and finding paths are no harder because the proof is a path. It's the dual path. So here's an example of a situation where you can see that paths aren't involved. So suppose we had 1D percolation, right? And we wanted to say One kind of path would be paths, and the other point would just be points. If we had 3D percolation, suppose you have a path from right to left, that would just be a path. But a proof that there was no path wouldn't be another path. It would have to be an entire slice, right? So it's the dimensions are, you know, so there's an ambient dimension. The proof dimension is the ambient dimension minus the search dimension. Okay, it just happens in two dimensions. 2 minus 1 is 1. It's very special. So one special feature of this is, and it's what makes it so easy, is that the proof that no path exists is the I show you another path in the other direction. Okay, so that's one misleading thing. The other thing is, in general, short proofs may not exist. Here they do. Okay. So that's a very misleading thing about this. Okay, so the idea is that, but because of this, we can collapse everything. It turns out checking whether or not a path is there, well, once I show you a path, you can then check whether I'm lying to you or not, right? Pretty easily. If I show you a path, you can pretty quickly tell whether or not I've made a mistake. So that's the easy part. That's the functional evaluation. I show you a path. Is it a path? I claim I have a path. Is it a path? That's a functional evaluation. Then finding a path is harder, but not terribly harder. We can do it. Then finding a proof is harder, but not terribly harder. We can do it. The reason that's good is that it lets us easily study this problem in a fairly accessible way. Okay. So again, there's all sorts of things wrong with this. There's no notion of internal versus external complexity. The computational complexity is a little oversimplified, and this notion of duality is oversimplified. So there's a lot of oversimplifications here. So I have to be very careful about what lesson we draw from this, but we can draw an important lesson. Okay. So the internal versus external complexity is that real biology and both technology use extremely complex internal hierarchies and organizations to create the illusion of simplicity. Right? We're not capturing that at all. So we have no distinction between the internal complexity and external behavior. So an essential feature of biology is just tossed out the window here. All the problems here are basically in this class P and are therefore sort of easy. So we lose this big distinction between evaluation, search, and verification. We'll make some analogies. And then duality is greatly simplified. Okay, so there's some great simplifications here. But so the robustness problem now is there an existence of a horizontal path is the basic question. The verification is to prove there exists a horizontal path or prove there isn't one. The complexity is either the length of the path or the length of the proof that there isn't one. And the model fragility is the minimum number of site changes to break a horizontal path. So if a horizontal path exists, okay. And notice that there's no difference between finding a horizontal path and proving there's no vertical one, or finding a vertical one and proving there's a horizontal one. That is not true in general. In general, search and proof are not the same. Here they are. It makes it easy. Okay. So we're just going to focus on horizontal paths. It's all symmetric, right? So we're going to focus on the existence of horizontal paths, their fragility and their robustness and their complexity. Okay, so I'm going to draw these little small lattices so that you can visualize everything, but you got to kind of help me at times and imagine that the lattices could be a lot bigger. Okay, so now here's the definition we're going to use. Again, we're trying to get something that's really, really accessible. So you're the computer. Okay, and what you have to do is you have to do the computational problem by looking at the system, at the lattice, and you have to figure out what the answer is. Okay, so this can be easy or hard, right? It's not exactly the same as the formal definition of minimum path length. It's close enough. Okay. Okay, and we can make it rigorous. So here's the deal, is we have four cases, right? Does there exist a horizontal path? They're either yes or no, and it's either easy or hard to determine it. Okay? And you should just look. So on the upper left-hand corner, it's easy to see that there's no path. In the upper right-hand corner, it's easy to see there's a path. And the other two, well, it's kind of hard. It's a little bit harder, right? You can do it if you stare long enough, but it's a little bit harder.
I don't get it.
What?
What's a path? Is a path through, like, all black space?
All black space now. All black space, right? Yeah.
In the null part, you can see a path going down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But if I gave you a huge lattice and put it right at the critical point, you'd never get it. You could stare at it for days and you wouldn't know. And the problem is you have to imagine this blown up, right? That's what, yeah, you got to imagine it blown up. Okay. Now, if I color it, it becomes really easy, right? If I do the coloring for you, then I've actually computed paths, whether or not paths exist. And that makes it easy. Okay. Note that the proof of the, so this is another important point, is that it can often be easier to describe the path than it is even to describe the lattice, right? If the path is just a list of points that are occupied in a path, you can go and check that list of points. That's actually a lot easier than even checking whether or not what the points are in the lattice, right? So it isn't necessarily that the complexity of the proof is even harder than the statement of the problem in the beginning. That's important because we want proofs much shorter than the complexity of the systems we build. We want to build incredibly complex systems that have short proofs. So that's another important point, an engineering problem. Okay, so here's the orthodox story about this, is that somehow the hard problems are associated with this phase transition. There's a phase transition here at 0.59, and if you're around 0.59 density, it gets hard. Okay, that's true. Nothing wrong with that. Problem is, it only works for random lattices. So here's exactly the opposite of this, right? Here's a low density, easy and robust yes, right? That can't happen over here, right? Here is a high density no, it's easy. This is hard, right? So this is exactly the opposite of the one in the lower right-hand corner, right? Obviously, these aren't random lattices, so you can say, oh, I'm cheating, right? Well, engineering isn't random either, and biology isn't random either. Okay, so we want to try to study not just the lower right-hand corner, but the whole picture, right? So there are 16 different actual possible combinations. You can have yes or no, easy or hard, low or high density, or robust or fragile, right? Actually, all 16 possibilities, you can make up a lattice that has it. So everything's possible, right? There is no association of anything with a phase transition, in general, only for random lattices. Well, we're going to just look at 8, right? We're going to only look at the yes case, because remember, the yes case and the no case are the same. It's just vertical versus horizontal. Okay. So here are 8 cases. And you can sort of see what they are. Up in the left-hand corner, robust, it's easy to tell. Fragile, but easy to tell. Okay? And again, robustness and fragile is just, can I cut it easily? How many points do I have to remove to cut it? Okay. Again, we can make this precise. But your visual feel for what we mean by fragile is exactly right. And it's also we have things that are fragile but hard to tell. Now this is fragile, but it's kind of hard for me to tell. I can tell that it's fragile, but I can't tell whether or not it's connected. I can sort of, and I can wind through and I can say, oh yeah, it is. But again, I can make it so you can't. Okay, I just made it hard enough that you could see that it was, but see that it was harder. And over here, right, we've got some easy robust things. This is kind of interesting. Like, see this guy? It's fragile because of that little thing right there, right? And it's robust because there isn't one. So, okay. But notice I don't have any examples. I don't have an example here. Okay. I said there was 8 possibilities, and now I show you only 6. Is it because I'm stupid and can't construct one? Or is there none in that corner? Okay. This is an important question, because the question is, can we have robust systems that are hard to verify? That's our nightmare. If there are such systems, we have problems, because that's the way biology could be. And I claim that can't happen. We can't have that place is empty for a good reason.
Are you defining the fragility with respect to the size of the lattice?
Yeah, we'll get that. We're going to define. I have to actually make definitions out of all this.
Really thick links.
Yep.
That would mean it's not fragile, but just make a huge lattice, so it appears
to. It has to scale with the lattice, yeah.
Right.
Obviously, yeah. Okay, so here's all the possibilities. If you have the random case, there's really only 2 cases, right? and all these others are excluded. So I sort of claim that all the interesting stuff is kind of up here. All these things, you know, cars and airplanes and stuff, are all these cases, right? So I want to make a distinction. I haven't proven this yet. This is impossible. This is simply improbable in random lattices. Okay. But the whole point is, it's these, why is this interesting? This is scarce use of resources. This is a really interesting case. Scarce use of resources to build a robust and verifiably good system. That's where we want to be. Okay? In random lattices, that never happens. It's so unlikely that you can ignore it. Okay.
That means the quantum physics is wrong or hard.
Sorry?
Is quantum physics is a quantum system, robust or fragile?
Come tomorrow afternoon, there's a whole talk on that. Andrew Doherty tomorrow afternoon is going to talk about how to apply all of this stuff. Not this stuff, this is toy. When we get to the math later today and tomorrow morning, there's a bunch of math machinery, and then Andrew, the last talk tomorrow afternoon, will have nothing to do with biology, will have to do with quantum entanglement and issues associated with that, and how to use this machinery in that area. So he will answer all your questions about quantum mechanics tomorrow afternoon. So here's the theorem. I have to define what these terms are, and then we'll try to prove this theorem. Here's the theorem, that fragility, which I have to define, is greater than or equal complexity plus scarcity. Okay, that excludes those regions because they are they would be highly complex, scarce, or scarce. Okay, here's the idea. Random lattices only have a sort of critical phase transition picture, right? So they don't violate this, but they're this very, very special case. So here's how you define everything. Okay, so what I've got here is the purple is the occupied sites, and the blue is a path in it. N is the length of a side, rho is the density, L is the minimum path length. Okay, and you can sort of, if you don't want to see the proof, if you sort of believe me at this point, you can kind of hum the way through this. Actually, it's all just elementary. It's completely, completely, completely elementary. Okay, so there would be a typical minimum path. It's not the only one, they're not unique, right? Okay, so I want to say L is the minimum path length, whatever that happens to be. Okay, so now B is the minimum cut barrier length, which is, I've indicated a minimum cut. Okay? So that would be a vertical path associated with that cut, right? I've taken the white space and I made a cut, now I have a vertical path. So that would be a proof that I had made a successful cut and there was no longer a horizontal path. Okay, so now we have to make our definitions. We always assume a path exists, and so we're discussing the case of a path exists. Okay, so we're going to define S as the resource scarcity. It's minus the log of the density, okay? And we're going to find the path length, as you suggested, normalized by this dimension, right? So it's the percentage of the dimension that you have to have a path length. So this is you always have to have this be, this is always at least 1 or log is 0. Right. So S here is always between 0 and log n. L is always between 0 and log n. And the path fragility is n over the number of points you need to cut it out. It's also between 0 and log n. Okay? So you want this to be small, you'd like this to be small, and you'd like this to be small. These are all good things to have be small. You want to use, actually you want this to be big. You want to have scarce resources, if you can, and you want to have low complexity and low fragility. Okay. And then the theorem is just F is greater than or equal to L plus S. Okay. And actually the proof is like completely trivial. Okay. So here's the proof. Produced by Glenn Vinicombe and a small amount of sushi. So this is a little, this is like a year ago, and we're sitting around in Westwood, and we go, This is at an internet conference. Like, oh, you know, we sketched it on a napkin, and he goes, okay, here's the proof. Okay. So to provide robust, it's so easy, to bust of these changes, there must be at least B independent paths, right? Okay? Which by assumption have to have a minimum length L. Then necessarily the density, rho times n squared is a number of sites, has to be bigger than that. That's the number of occupied sites, that's the number on your independent paths. Take logs of it, and you get that. Right. I get, this is yeah, this is pretty simple, right? Okay. It's maximally tight in the sense that you can hit all the corner, anything that's allowed by this exists. So not only is it true, but it's the least conservative combination of these quantities that you can put together and also be true. Okay. Okay, so anything is possible consistent with this theorem. So what that means is of the 8 possibilities, the 6 remaining are all possible. So we'll just consider the 8 cases. Okay, so we can draw this picture, which is, has us in this, we can go scarce to rich, robust to fragile, and easy to hard along these axes, right? Okay. But only this up, only this little corner is possible. Okay, so we're going to just focus on this corner. Okay, so we got this fragile face, we got a rich face, and we got an easy face. Okay. So here is a easy, fairly robust case that sits in that corner. So we can hit that edge. And we can just scoot along that edge, right? We can go, this is like robust, right? But we can stay easy and robust and go along the edge to the scarce region, right? We can be easy and fragile. We can go along that edge. Notice that all we've done is kind of made it really fragile here. So we can kind of scoot along that edge. It's about as fragile, so you're as fragile as you can possibly be, right? This is the back edge. This is the back face, right? That's the face that hits the constraint, right? And you have to do this kind of weird thing, right? Okay. So you can construct something that sits on the back face. Blah, blah, blah. Proof of that. Okay. Okay, so you can construct all these cases. So you can construct weird cases like this. You can sit on this fragile face. You can sit on the fragile face like that. You can also fit the fragile face like this. Make it very complicated, right? You can sit up on this face. You're wondering what the hell this has to do with biology, right? We'll get there, right? Good question. At this point, you got to be wondering, what the hell am I doing? Okay. So we have this whole fragile face. Look at there's all these interesting ways you can be fragile, right? You can be fragile in a sort of obvious way, or you can be fragile in a sort of complicated way, right? So you can be sort of, this is the hard and fragile. You're fragile, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to figure it out. I mean, here you can actually see, but that's because I made it very regular. Okay. So we have these four corners, right? And this is sort of, this is rich and hard. That's sort of, and fragile? No. Yeah, rich and fragile and hard. That's kind of Microsoft. I think that's kind of me. Not rich. I don't know. I'm very fragile, though. That's why you get into stuff, right? There's a psychological thing. You study the thing that you are most deficient in. And I've always been this incredibly fragile person. I break so easy. I wouldn't have been an academic otherwise, so that's probably good. Okay, so the most fragile face is this corner here. The most robust place is here, right? Okay. Now, let's go back to our StatMex story. Where is that? Well, that's this curve in here, right? I haven't said exactly what it is. It'd actually be kind of cute to figure out exactly where this is for a particular case. Homework exercise. But notice what happens is you start out very, you know, very robust, and you go through and you hit this fragile face. And where do you hit the fragile face? You hit the fragile face at the phase transition, right? So if your whole world consisted of that little green line, you would be right. Fragility and complexity, because of the theorem, is associated with a phase transition. Okay. But of course, all the action is away from that. All the action is over here. Highly efficient, robust, far from random, right? I mean, biology really is like that. It's highly structured, right? And here's how you can tell. Does it matter if you rearrange the parts? Here, if you just go and scramble this, it totally screws it up, right? Scramble these pictures, nothing much changes. Okay? So an easy test, if you want to know, is a system like this or is it like this, open it up, take the parts, throw them all over the floor, and then have your four-year-old put it back together. Okay? If it still works, you're over here, right? Okay? And otherwise, you're here. So try that with, oh, I don't know, your car. Or actually do that, you know, I don't know, you don't want to, don't try that, you know, try that with maybe a bacterial cell. Don't do that with your, don't do that with your own body parts. Okay. So it isn't, no, so notice that I'm not saying that this is wrong, right? I'm just saying there's a much more inclusive picture. Okay, let me go back. So the question is, how general is this? Okay. So I've told you a cartoon story with very simple mathematics. I set all these caveats about how it doesn't apply to the general case. It's all these very special things about it, right? Very, very special. No duality gap, all this kind of stuff. The question is, does this in essence, when correctly translated? So remember, we have, this was just a particular F, right? I picked a particular F in which I could do functional evaluation, I could do search, and I could do proof. For this class of Fs, this holds. The question is, does this story hold in general, no matter what kinds of Fs you have? Fs that are much harder to do than this. Functions that are much harder. So far, every case where you know it is or isn't true, it's true. So Pablo will tell you later about linear programming, about we know a whole lot of cases. And the key thing is it true in this world of P, NP, and co-NP? We don't know yet for sure. We don't even know if they're different, right? I mean, so being very definitive about that world. But it appears to be. And this is a really, really different way of looking at that problem. It's a numerical analyst's way of looking at the problem, not a traditional computational complexity way of looking at it. Okay. So what ends up happening is all of these different communities now have sort of handcrafted ways of taking their hard problems and making them easy. And we're doing that in biology. But the more important thing is that we've tried, well, let me go. One of the more important things is, which I don't have the picture of, is that we've got this general infrastructure, which you're going to hear about. That's the rest of today and tomorrow morning, a general infrastructure for how to do the story I just told you, but with dynamical systems. First was sort of just equations. So first Pablo will talk about polynomial equalities and inequalities. That's sort of the steady state behavior of biology, with lots of other applications. Tomorrow morning you'll hear about dynamical systems, and the idea is that the same story plays out. But what we have to be able to do there is we have to be able to systematically generate short proofs. Here it was easy. A short proof was simply another path. In general, short proofs may not exist, so we have to have ways of systematically generating short proofs. These subjects have each handcrafted their own ways of doing short proofs. And as a consequence, there's a sort of Tower of Babel, because the way each one of them has done it is completely different than what everybody else has done. And so as a consequence, they have a hard time talking to each other. So one of the benefits of a unified theory is that you can see that all these little handcrafted solutions are just part of a general approach. That's one of the benefits. But there's also a huge difference between how these communities view things. So there's a tendency over here to kind of assume things are random or generic, right? The underlying things. That you can take the component parts, the modules, and they don't satisfy a protocol. There isn't the law about how they're connected. There's just very general things. You can rearrange them. Over here, these people tend to assume that things are optimal, right? Or worst case. And of course, a key thing is getting a bigger picture that includes both of those. Obviously, we want that. And what I tried to suggest was that what I suggested in this lattice picture, so these people think of things as optimal and worst case. And so it's actually, there's kind of a, it's easy for people here to talk to each other. It's sort of easy for people to talk to here. So it's one of the reasons why I think, for example, physicists find information theory so attractive. because it basically is very, very familiar. You take a document and you forget all of its structure. It's just this unstructured set of code words with some entropy and probability. And of course, the brilliance of Shannon is that it makes any sense at all. I mean, a priori, I'm going to compress a document by ignoring that it has any meaning at all? That sounds insane. It's brilliant. That's what's so brilliant about it, is that it actually is very effective. To completely ignore the structure. So a compressed file, you could have gone and just rearranged things, it doesn't matter, right? Now what they've done in order to do that is on top of that, you do highly optimized, so then the coded system, you can't recombine, right? The source you can. So sort of a cartoon version is, this is the way you think of things down here. You think of things as random. Here you think of things as very, very highly structured, right? And what I'm claiming is that there is a view of these that is inclusive of them all. It's going to be very hard for us in the next day to give you much of a flavor of that more inclusive view. You've seen a cartoon of it here. Once I show you this picture, it's easy to see how this part of it fits in. It's easy to see why you would associate that point with fragility. But you can also see in a bigger context that you could have things like this, and you can pull that apart. So there's a much more general picture here in which you can include both the highly structured story that occurs sort of on the edges of this diagram and this random story which occurs along a sort of green line through it. Okay? So at least I have hinted to you that there might be a more inclusive story that lets you capture in one setting both the random and generic story and the optimal and worst case. And there is. There's much of that. It's not a complete finished story. And one of the things, of course, we're trying to do, which we're not going to talk much about, is how this plays out in physics. Okay. So the idea is that... Okay. So the bad news is that some of the hoped-for connections between phase transition and complexity are not entirely there. The good news is it hinted at something that was right. So we have this more inclusive view. And it turns out, actually, this has deep implications for physics itself. And so one of the ideas that's been a big theme in research over the last few decades is the idea that the connection between phase transitions and complexity would give us insights into all internet traffic topology, all these things, right? Okay. And I think that was worth a shot. And then the question is, you can simply ask, if I go into my laptop and rearrange the chips, does it still work? And the answer is no. So maybe this isn't going to work. Okay. So the idea is that these things are all, the idea is that a tornado and an airplane are pretty much the same, right? They're nonlinear, far from equilibrium systems, right? But if you're a passenger, they're very different, right? And so in some sense, I'm more interested in how tornadoes and... let me put it this way. I'm as interested in how tornadoes are different than Boeing 777s as I am in how they're alike. I think both questions are interesting. I think the way they're alike is interesting. They are alike. They can both carry large objects over long distances. They are both far from equilibrium phenomena. Okay, they involve interesting fluid dynamics. But there's obviously big differences, right? And obviously I would prefer one versus the other. So this story really hasn't worked. But it's been a very interesting story. It was a question that had to be investigated, right? We had to know that answer, and it's a good conjecture. The interesting part is that we now have a rich new theory that is starting to integrate these things on the right-hand side. And the implications for physics, in fact, are quite interesting. So why are there power laws? Why are there coherent structures in shear flow turbulence? Looking at stat-mech for non-equilibrium systems, quantum entangled, quantum information technology. Okay, so there's lots of new applications of this. Of course, this is a workshop on biology, but because this is the KITP, we had to throw in a little physics. So the last talk on Friday is going to take all the machinery you're going to learn about in the next 4.5 hours and look at it in the context of quantum entanglement and sort of quantum information. And Andrew Dory is going to do that. And he's a real physicist, so he'll say less bad things about physics. I'm trying not to be too bashful about physics. But the other thing is, the other players in this are easily accessible. So Gene Carlson here in physics at Santa Barbara is an expert on this aspect of the story. So if you want to hear about why are power laws all over the place from this point of view, Which is a different point of view than the critical phase transition story. Talk to Gene Carlson if you want to know the expert on coherent structures and how this whole story plays out, the connection between complexity and fragility and robustness plays out in turbulence. Bassam Bamier is the expert. Lots of people working on this. Some people here and some people at Caltech. This is going slow because everybody's working on all these other things. And then there's this activity centered at Caltech, Hideo Mabuchi, Andrew Doherty working on applying these tools in the context of quantum entanglement. There's a paper that appeared in PhysRev Letters last year. Andrew tomorrow will talk about this. Okay. So here's the lessons, basically. Highly evolved systems are robust yet fragile. Complexity implies fragility, and this order-disorder transition, it's not wrong. I don't want to say that there isn't an association between phase transitions and complexity. It's just that little green thread, right? And it doesn't get the bigger picture. And there's a more inclusive view in which you can still see that picture and still see its validity, but also see a bigger picture. And so the essence, again, is that complexity implies fragility. In particular, dual complexity is the important part. And what happened was I gave you an example in which duality didn't play a strong role. So duality here was, let me tell you what duality was again. Duality was the difference between proving that if I had constructed a vertical path, remember back when I started, I said you could construct a vertical path or a horizontal path. Okay. The vertical path, if the construction of a horizontal path is my primal problem, then my dual problem is the construction of a vertical path. Why is it dual? It's dual because if it exists, it proves that the previous problem had no solution. So I can pursue any question as a primal problem or a dual problem. In this case, if I said the primal problem is finding a horizontal path, I could either search for a horizontal path. But suppose I search for a while and I don't find one. I might change my strategy and go look for a vertical path. Or I might do both together. If I find a vertical path, then I have a proof that there was no horizontal path. So the primal problem is a horizontal path. The dual problem is a vertical path. Very misleading property of this is that they were essentially the same. In general, they aren't. That's one of the most important messages you'll get in the next talk. Okay. But what was true here is that it is true. What is general about this, which you didn't get here, was that dual complexity implies primal fragility. The fragility is always in the other part of the problem. Here, it all kind of collapsed, and that's misleading about this part of it. And so the dual complexity is proof link. The primal fragility is just this ill conditioning, the fact that small changes in the problem change the answer. Okay. So here's how this is going to fit together in the rest of this today and tomorrow. Is that we have to model things in such a way that we can use the machinery. And it turns out the way we model things is like biologists do. You write down mass action kinetics. But in general, what you have to do is you have to describe your system as sets of nonlinear equations or differential equations. We're working on PDEs. PDEs is in Antonis is maybe going to say a little bit about that tomorrow. I don't know. But mostly it's DAEs, differential algebraic equations. Then what you have to do is you have to turn it over to a bunch of machinery. And that machinery is what's the next subject to be talked about. I haven't even said anything about it. Okay. And so the hope is that machinery is going to be relatively transparent. There's certainly a lot of software you can use, but hopefully the ideas in it are going to be accessible. So the reason it works, if this was all there was to it, it wouldn't necessarily work very well. Okay. Because what could happen is we model a system, and then we go and we try to analyze it, and we just don't get anywhere. And so one of the themes of this, in a very general sense, is how do you make a system robust? You got to have feedback. And here's the feedback. The feedback is if you attempt a proof and it takes a long time and you struggle and you can't get anywhere, there's actually a problem with your model to begin with. Okay. And this can be wrong in a lot of ways. The actual system itself could be fragile in a way you haven't identified. And the identification of that fragility is actually the exercise we're all after in the first place. But it could have been you made an assumption, and that assumption introduced a fragility that wasn't in the real system. Or you could have made some numerical approximations in creating the model. And so there's lots of places that fragility can enter. And you can't tell over here. You get hints. You can tell mathematically where it is, but you don't know where it is in a meaningful model sense. So you've got to have this proof complexity map back into model fragility. Then you go over here, and then you have to iterate on your model. You might have to go do new experiments. One of the important answers in all this is that you can get in a situation where the only resolution is to do another experiment. And so if you don't have this closed loop, then this process can't work. Why is this hard? Every one of those boxes comes from completely separate disciplines that have never talked to each other before. Okay. So if you are in the business of modeling biological systems, you're happy to turn your questions into problems either of stochastic simulations or solving differential algebraic equations or something. But then all of the kinds of stuff that we do with respect to how you deal with unmodeled dynamics, what about the aspects of the model that aren't parametric? That all sort of falls into sort of robust control theory, and the math of that is this sort of operator Banach algebras. You'll hear a little bit about that tomorrow. But we certainly won't tell you anything about that. We're going to tell you something hopefully a lot simpler than that. And then once you do that, you turn it into a whole analysis problem, and all this stuff is traditionally had no connection with this. Actually, the amazing thing is there's a couple mathematicians in the world that actually have worked on both these problems, and one of them's in the audience, so it's pretty cool. So, but mostly operator theorists and real algebraic geometers never talk to each other, fair to say, right? So, but now that's starting to change. And Pablo is the person who kind of put this story together. But then this whole picture is sort of in all of this, it's numerical analysis and theoretical computer science, right? So these are all just completely separate areas. So what we're going to try to do, and the whole point is we believe this is quite relevant to taking biology, doing an analysis of it, and then going back and doing not just refinements of the models, but I think, in fact, the more important thing is going back and which experiments should you do next? What experiments do you have to do in order for this process to converge to a complete and coherent understanding of the thing you're after? So the stuff we did this morning, right, was all this kind of hand wave, you know, we'd make these models, we'd run some simulations, we'd give you some intuition and stuff. We want proofs. We want to be able to scale that. We want to be able to do that for big networks, right? How do we do that? How do we do these controlled mathematical comparisons that Mike Savageau has talked about for much more complex systems? So the idea is that is a model structure consistent with set of data? So that's the kind of question you want ask. So model and simulation is only a small part of the problem. So if you can do model and simulation, that's just a small part of what we need to do. Okay, I think I'll stop there. So questions? Yeah.
Just a terminology question.
Yeah. They're systems that involve discrete logic and continuous dynamics. So for example, a typical place that would arise in biology is you would abstract out some gene regulatory network to just be a Boolean network.
So this machinery is going to address.
Yes, and so one of the hard problems is if you have a system that's partially discrete, so imagine you modeled a very large biochemical network, but you decided that you were going to make a simplified. You say, oh, I got some high Hill coefficients here, and I'm going to simplify. It's dubious whether or not this is actual simplification, but suppose you think it is. You simplify and replace a whole bunch of differential equations with Boolean logic for genes being either on or off, right? And you get rid of the dynamics associated, the continuous dynamics. But then you still might have some cytoplasmic protein stuff that would have differential equations. So if you have simply Boolean logic, then you have simply a discrete logical system. If you have just differential equations, then you just have differential algebraic equations. It's when you have those two together what we call hybrid. Okay. And so one of the exciting aspects of this is that we can work those problems. Now, the technological implications of that are probably even bigger because that means we can take, we at least in principle have a research path to take on which could be sort of the nightmare problem of the 21st century, which is this embedded networked systems. But that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with biology, but that's what a hybrid is. Any other questions? Yeah?
So how does that, the percolation caricature that you did, how how is it not surprising? Because it's already known, kind of both by populists who deal with percolation problems and physicists, that kind of fixed points that you get from, let's say, 2D percolation are both the critical one where it's more disordered, whereas then also then you have more, but there are two other ones. One that's trivial, where it's basically not dense at all, so basically just plain, and the other one where it's rich and where it's fully. Those end up being the two stable fixed points.
Yeah, so they would actually be points in that little diagram too. Yeah.
But the unstable one is actually the critical.
Right.
And so that's it. But there are other phase transition physics which are actually stable. In which case, I mean, how would that fit in?
Yeah, I wasn't attempting to fit all of the phase transition questions in. It was just this issue. The only issue that I'm not even sure other. I think a lot of aspects of the study of phase transitions doesn't fit in this picture. The part that does fit in is this association of phase transitions with high complexity, computational complexity. It does fit into the picture. And in that picture, it's a point kind of on a surface in this kind of diagram, right? But the more general, I think one of the interesting things to look at is how much can we do a statistical mechanics, and you've thought about this so you know some of the answers. How could we do a version renormalization that would apply to design systems, highly structured patterns, and the idea is that you have to do different things at different scales. And so I think an interesting question is how much of StatMet can you do for systems that are far away from equilibrium and regulated to be there, which is biology and engineering. And so the problem is the conventional methods of even non-equilibrium StatMet just don't work in systems that are very far away from equilibrium and highly regulated. And again, you know that as well as anybody. So you're going to fix that, right? Good. So you're not going to hear about that aspect of this because we're going to dump down to the quantum level. So that's a research problem right now, which is to try to develop. And the difficulty is, I think the quantum story is attractive because it doesn't require as radical a shift in thinking as does the StatMech story. So the story that Andrew will tell you, I don't think requires as radical a shift in thinking as the StatMech story requires. Really quite substantial shift in even the way that you pose the problems. It's not just a matter of, you know, using new math machinery to solve a well-established problem, which is what Andrew will primarily do. Any other questions? Any biology questions? Okay. Okay, so we're going to take maybe about a half-hour break and come back at 3:30, and we'll hear Pablo tell you the real story.